Hi everyone, this is Sally Gao, introducing another episode of Enable by East Coast Capital, where we speak with institutional investors and corporate founders. Today, we're excited to be chatting with Monica Erickson, who is the head of investment grade corporate credit at Double Line Capital. And now I will turn the call over to East Coast Capital partner, Anthony Valencia.
Thank you, Sally. So I'm very pleased to be chatting with my friend and former colleague, Monica Erickson at Double Line Capital. Thanks for joining us today, Monica.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to do this.
Absolutely. Maybe we could start with kind of just some high-level thoughts on the investment grade market. Maybe you could give us your, an update year to date. What were you thinking, or what was the consensus thinking in the IG market towards the beginning of the year? And obviously, we had a lot of volatility and, a tumultuous year in the stock market. So, where are we now from what you thought was happening towards the beginning of the year, and just kind of, set the stage from there, and then we can dig down into some of the more topical issues like inflation and recession and so on and so forth.
Sure. Yeah, well, this year has been one of the worst years. Frankly, I think Deutsche Bank did a study going back to the 1800s. So one of the worst years for the bond market overall in terms of returns. The investment grade market is down a little bit over 13% year to date. So not really what investors look for in what should be a fairly stable market. Really what's been going on is treasury yields have been rising at a very rapid pace. We've had a Fed that has had to put on the brakes because of all of the flood of money that had gone into the system, creating what we now have, this massive inflationary problem. And frankly, it's something that we as a firm have been talking about for some time. And one of the problems with the investment grade corporate market is that it has a very long duration, meaning it has very high sensitivity to any kind of movement in rates or spreads. And so that negative 13% return that I was talking about 80% of that has come because of the move in the treasury market. So it's, like I said, not only has the investment grade market, but frankly, all of fixed income has just had a very tough year in terms of returns.
Got it. It's interesting because year to date, the high yield market has actually outperformed the investment grade market, which to some would be kind of counterintuitive because, generally we think of high yield as more risky than investment grade. Can you just talk to that quickly in the context of duration and interest rate risk?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that it really goes back to that duration and really an interest rates. And looking at returns, high yield had been outperforming. High yield now is just ever so slightly outperforming. So what's been going on in the two markets is the high yield market spreads have actually widened more than the investment grade market, which you would expect in this type of environment where there's more risks out there. But the returns really have been driven by the duration part, by the sensitivity to the moves in both interest rates and spreads. And so, what we were talking about just starting this conversation, that the IG market has been so impacted by the move in treasury rates because of its long duration. And that is why the market has been underperforming the high yield market. And the high yield market in this environment has actually been able to outperform really back to the duration numbers. And I think you and I were talking about this before, just to give your listeners some kind of sense as to how sensitive each market is to these shifts in spreads and treasury rates. The high yield market has a duration of about 4 years, meaning that every 100 basis point move one way or the other in terms of spreads or rates is about a 4% move. Whereas the investment grade market has a duration of about 7.5 years. So almost double the move per movement in either spreads or rates. So this is what we're dealing with. Super long duration asset class. It's getting whipsawed around by what's going on in the treasury market.
Got it. Thanks for that very, very thorough explanation. So earnings season started in earnest last week. What are you looking for? You know, from the perspective of an investment grade investor, what would be a satisfactory earnings season for you?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that we're really listening to companies this earnings season, because I think this is really a pivotal quarter to see how companies are dealing with what is on everyone's top of mind, inflation, seeing how companies are able to either pass along their higher costs, their higher input costs, and also seeing kind of like what credit quality is like for the consumer. So far, the large money center banks have reported. We had Citi, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley report last week. We had Bank of America and Goldman Sachs report today. We also had Synchrony Financial report today, which is a credit card issuer. And what we're listening for from the banks is really just the credit quality of the consumer. And it's interesting to hear what they are talking about, which is that the consumer, while maybe not as strong as they were 6 months ago, is still in relatively good shape and frankly, better off than they were kind of pre-COVID, pre-2020. And I think that is going to flow into all other kind of consumer activity. Now, that's what they're seeing right now. I think that, Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan has been very vocal out there talking about that the future is very uncertain and it's very difficult to predict. So, you know, we're looking at kind of what we're dealing with right now, but I think going forward, there is a lot of uncertainty out there, and there is a big question whether the Fed is going to be able to deliver on their dual mandate and not kill the economy and send us into a deep recession, while at the same time being able to control this high inflationary environment that we're in. So I think we definitely have more risk in the market, but I have been surprised more on the upside in terms of the bank's earnings, that they have come in basically in line with what we were expecting. I think some of the theme with the banks is investment banking is down substantially. I think kind of the average is about 50%. JP Morgan's, I think, was down only 10%, which was better. But it's reflective of that, you know, there's really not a lot of new issuance happening. There's not a lot of IPOs happening. I think M&A transactions have slowed down, all because there's this risk. But the banks on the flip side have been able to make up some of that with their net interest margin. So part of how they do their business, right, is they lend money at a higher rate than they themselves can borrow money, and they make that spread. And that has been positive for the banks. And frankly, some of their other business lines have made up for the drop in investment banking. And one other thing you had were discussing prior to doing the podcast was just the issue of share buybacks and kind of the balance sheet of the banks. And as we were talking about, JP Morgan has halted their share buybacks, which from a credit perspective is a very positive announcement. And it's different for the equity side, because you always like to see share buybacks. But what we like to see is companies putting their capital towards strengthening their balance sheet. And that's exactly what halting share buybacks does.
Right. And that's a very interesting point. And obviously, the banks are, you know, somewhat of an animal unto themselves, in that they have certain capital requirements that, you know, non-bank, non-financial companies don't necessarily have. Do you think that the announcement about, you know, halting buybacks and whatnot is any sort of harbinger for, you know, non-financial companies that could essentially, you know, adversely affect equity returns. Because, you know, we've seen over the past decade, more or less, that there's been this very high correlation between share buybacks and equity performance. So if we're entering a period where, you know, corporate treasurers are tightening the belt and reducing the repurchases, what do you think is the implication for the equity markets, if any?
Yeah, well, I think to your point, the banks really are a different animal than, call it, you know, some industrial companies, right? The banks are so highly regulated and their capital ratios now were just increased, meaning that the Fed is requiring them to retain more capital because there is more risk in the system. So I think while halting share buybacks is a negative for equity holders, it really is a positive for credit holders, right? Because it strengthens the balance sheet. It keeps more liquidity on the balance sheet. And then in addition to halting their share repurchases, they also increase their reserves, meaning that they're holding back capital to allow them to have more buffers in the event that there are more losses on the loans that they're making. So from a credit perspective, it's all very positive. Now, whether that it means that other companies are going to follow suit and also announce that they're going to be halting share buybacks because, and I would assume that they would be doing that because they would have some sort of balance sheet constraint. We haven't seen that. Now, the industrials haven't started to report earnings yet. We do have AT&T and Verizon, which are the two larger telecom companies in our index that are reporting later this week. And I know they've both been focused on the balance sheet. So I think usually when companies announce those types of initiatives, i.e. Not repurchasing shares, it usually has to do with them wanting to shore up their balance sheet, which frankly, for credit investors, is what we want to see. Now, the flip side is if it's really like just a horrific quarter and there is something really troubling going on with the business model, or they're not going to be able to weather through this cyclical environment, and it's forced on them to stop share buybacks, and they have, in addition to that, a continuing deteriorating balance sheet. You know, that's obviously not good for either class of holder, either equity or the credit.
Got it. So you mentioned the R word, recession, a little bit earlier in our conversation. And, you know, the bond market has a reputation for being the market that sniffs out problems before the equity market does. But, you know, we've already seen this big downturn in the equity market. You know, we officially hit a bear market at one point. So for people that aren't making investment grade bond allocation decisions on a daily basis like you are, you know, maybe you're a founder of a company, or, you know, wearing my hat in the private equity world, and you're trying to really just figure out what the bond market is telling you with respect to the overall economy. What is it inferring right now? You know, on one day, the 10-year treasury would be up because there's inflation expectations. And, you know, a few days later, it'll be down because people are talking about the Fed starting QE in 2023 and, you know, demand destruction and a recession coming. So, you know, it's hard to, the daily ups and downs are hard to keep track of, and what the market story is for the day. So is it too late to glean anything from what the bond market is telling us? Is the horse out of the barn, or can we still draw some conclusions as of now?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, because there has been a lot more volatility in the treasury market than there has been in the standalone credit market. And what I mean by that is just in terms of where spreads have gone. So, you know, just backing up a little bit, as an investor in investment grade corporate bonds, you get a total yield. And your total yield is made up of the treasury component. And then you get some extra spread on top of that for taking credit risk, because the credit quality of an investment grade company is not as high as the faith of the United States government, right? So you get paid this extra spread. Now that extra spread, while it has been out year to date, has not been as volatile as the treasury market. So we see spreads move anywhere between, call it what, 1 to 3, sometimes not at all, 1 to 3 basis points a day, sometimes zero. Where we've been seeing movements in the treasury market, you know, 10, 20 basis points a day. So a lot more volatility in the treasury market. And I think that is because it's just been so much more of a macro call, and this concern about being able to address inflation in a way that does not kill the economy. And historically, the Fed has not been able to walk that fine line of being able to squash inflation without killing the economy. And so I think that's why we're seeing so much more volatility on the Treasury side than we are in terms of spreads. Now, one thing investors do look at is the spread level, and then extrapolating from that, thinking, so is the spread level telling me something about where the economy is going? And I think that was part of the question, right? So at spreads on the index level right now of 140 basis points, so you could get 1.4% more than you would on the equivalent treasury. Does that fully compensate you for the risk that is in the market? And that really is the question. So historically, that spread level when we're in a recession is closer to 200 basis points over. So if you're of the mind that we're in a recession, that 140 spread is not really compensating you, and not our, or the flip side is you could say the 140 spread is accurate and it's telling you that the economy is not going to go into a recession. So, you know, it's one or the other. I would also add in something you and I were talking about, that 140 spread on the index is not really indicative of where bonds, the underlying bonds, are actually really trading. So the underlying bonds, when you actually go and buy and sell a security and there's a market in it, seems to be probably 20, 30 basis points wider than that 140 spread. So there are a lot of bonds that don't trade, that are in the benchmark, that get traded or that get priced without an actual trade going through and are reflected in that 140 spread. So the spread is probably closer to, call it, 160. However, even at 160, I don't know, does that fully reflect, if we are going into a recession, does that fully reflect the risks? I would say probably not. But it's also indicating that perhaps we're not going into a recession. Now, one other thing I would add, you know, we don't have crystal balls, so it's very difficult to say whether are we in an in a recession right now, or are we headed into a recession. But there are some of the people that we work with closely. Jim Bianco, one of them, has been talking about this, I think, for about 2 months now. And he is fairly adamant that we are currently in a recession. I'm not seeing that yet from what I'm hearing from kind of corporate entities. But I think that there's definitely a much higher risk of us going into a recession, given where we are in terms of the inflationary picture, what the Fed needs to do. Long story short, I'm not sure that spreads fully reflect kind of the risks that are out there.
To your point on spreads the Fed having to clamp down on inflation and inflation expectations, how high can that spread go before kind of you hit a danger zone where the red lights start flashing?
Well, so, you know, you could see periods. I mean, in March of 2020, spreads got close to 400 over, and they only lasted for, I think it was maybe 5 days, something like that, before mm-hmm. the Fed stepped in and had their program. So I think, 200 over, and I would say this would be like an indication that we are either in a recession or expecting a significant slowdown. I think 200 over would be an appropriate level. But I think also we've seen historically that the Fed really is interested in making sure that the market, at least the investment grade corporate market, functions properly. Mm-hmm. It's critical for companies to be able to have access, especially larger companies, to be able to have access to capital. And so I think if we ever got into a period like we did in March of 2020, where we really had a completely non-functioning market, there would be something that would be done to alleviate that. But if we just get into kind of your normal, you know, ordinary kind of slowdown and, you know, you see unemployment rise and earnings fall and spreads widen and there's still some sort of functioning in the market, I think, you know, 200 over is probably where we would see spreads go.
You've made comments in the past that, you know, credit quality as of now is not an issue, that, you know, leverage ratios are good, that you know, interest coverage ratios are solid. But I remember back in, you know, the 08, 09 recession when, you know, overnight every equity analyst suddenly became a credit analyst. And, you know, I'm willing to bet that I probably called you or some of your colleagues back then and, you know, to get your opinion on, you know, the large cap media conglomerates that I was covering. Because to a certain extent, when the spreads get wide enough, you know, in the investment grade or the high yield market for that matter, it places an upside on the equity market. Because why buy the equities when you can, you know, be higher up in the capital structure and, you know, maybe you're 10, 20% below par, right? Maybe more if it's a high yield credit. So I guess my question is, how quickly can things change to where, you know, you're at 3x debt to EBITDA or 4x debt to EBITDA, and suddenly we hit a deep recession, and, you know, suddenly you're at 8x and you're bumping up against covenants, and, you know, it's problematic. So yeah, I guess it's a long-winded way of asking, like, how high can the Fed raise rates before it really becomes a problem?
Yeah, well, I think there's two components to that. There is the kind of debt level to kind of the serviceability of that debt. So the debt to EBITDA, like how much cash flow is the company earning in order to be able to repay that debt over a longer period of time. And then there's that interest coverage, right? So how much cash flow does a company have every year to be able to pay their interest expense? And that metric, that annual metric of just being able to cover the interest expense is at near historical high levels, just because companies over the last, call it 3 to 4 years, have done an incredibly good job of coming to market and issuing bonds at incredibly low rates and kind of pushing out their maturity walls, right? So we're not really seeing any kind of concerns in terms of companies having to reissue at higher rates at this point. You know, the banks have been fairly active in the new issue market, but they're also able to pass that along to their end consumer because they're charging higher rates. So we're not seeing any issues there. I think in terms of just the absolute debt that's outstanding and then that EBITDA, that cash flow number that companies have to pay it off over the long term. Obviously, if you have EBITDA drop by 50%, meaning your cash flow drops by 50%, mathematically, that number is going to go up twofold, right? So, you know, you could see the absolute debt to EBITDA levels increasing fairly significantly if we see a drop off. But I think what we tend to do is look at that through the cycle, as opposed to taking the absolute number at the low kind of EBITDA cash flow number. And the rating agencies look at it that way as well. But you'd also have to have comfort in that this is just would be a cyclical issue as opposed to some sort of secular issue. And that's really where, you know, deep credit analysis comes in and where I think we really add value for our clients is that, you know, we've got this group of analysts that really dig into the numbers and make sure that companies are able to service their debt. Now, in terms of like breaching covenants or coming up against covenants, that's much more of a high yield issue. The investment grade market, bonds, frankly, most bonds except for REITs are issued without any covenants. So the bigger concern there is really just that they push that leverage number up to a point where a rating agency might downgrade them, or they can't get the debt down soon enough to right size given their lower kind of cash flow number. So that would be the bigger concern in kind of investment grade land.
Well, I think regardless of where you are on the spectrum or whether you think the Fed stayed too low for too long, the one silver lining to your point is that companies, I think, were very prudent in you know, extending maturities and stabilizing their balance sheets so that hopefully some of the problems that we saw in, you know, 08, 09 don't repeat themselves. Switching gears a little bit, Monica, here, because we're running up against our time. You are one of the founders of the California Bloomberg Women's Buy-Side Network. Can you maybe tell our audience a little bit about this organization? And as you know, I've attended a couple of your events and have enjoyed them and have enjoyed listening to you speak at them.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you so much. Yes, we started this with the help of Bloomberg, and it's called the Bloomberg Women's Buy-Side Network. We started this last year, and we are the first chapter in the United States. It started in Asia 2 years ago. And so Bloomberg has been trying to build out that effort. And like I said, we started it last year. And we're trying to do events both in Los Angeles and in San Francisco. We're going to start doing some virtual events as well. So if anyone is interested in joining, they can just Google the Bloomberg Women's Buy-Side Network. And then if you've got a Bloomberg machine, you can find it on Bloomberg as well. There is at the very bottom of the page, there is an ability for you to sign up, and then you'll start getting all the newsletters, information on events. And really our goal is to bring more diversity into specifically the buy side. So portfolio managers, analysts, traders, anyone that's working on the buy side, we really encourage you to join the conversation. And really, it's open to both sexes. As Anthony said, he's come to our events, and we really welcome men participating. I think men have a lot of ability to affect change, and we really want to partner with everyone that's involved in the buy side. And it's super, super exciting. We've got three other founders that are really fantastic. One woman that's based in San Francisco, and the three of us, the other three, are based in Los Angeles, and just super excited to be a part of that. I would also add that, you know, with Bloomberg's resources, it's been really a treat to be able to participate in the organization. So thank you, Anthony, for asking me about that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, they've absolutely been just first class, great events. Well, I think we're up against the time, unfortunately. I have so many more questions I could ask you, Monica, but we really want to thank you for participating in this great and very informative and interesting discussion. And we hope that we can do another one of these down the line.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.